Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. I'm your host, Crimeaholly. Before we dive into the details of this case, I do just want to give a quick thank you to everyone who has taken the time to leave a review on your preferred podcast platform. It means a lot to creators when people not only give them a star rating, but also actually leave them kind words of encouragement. So if you've already left a review, just know I greatly appreciate you so much. Okay, so today's case I'm really excited to share with you guys because it was solved by some pretty incredible science. I just love that science is evolving and it's giving us new opportunities to solve cases that may have not been solved so quickly. Or like we often see recently, cold cases are being solved years down the road because of science advancements, and it's giving families answers and closure. I'm excited to see what the future holds for science and true crime. So let's get into today's case. Today's episode is on the murder of Munshie G. Munshie G was born on April 18, 1991 in Xi'an, China, to her parents Kei Ren and Xiao Ling. She was born under China's one-child policy. And in case you aren't familiar with what that is, the one-child policy was a program in China that limited most Chinese families to have only one child. According to Britannica.com, this was implemented by the Chinese government in 1980, and it was to address the growth rate of the country's population, which the government had viewed as being too rapid. This policy was eventually phased out in 2016. And even though Munshie was born under this policy, her parents only ever wanted one child. They wanted one child because they wanted to make sure that they could give that child the best life that they possibly could. They wanted to give all of their love and devotion to just one child. So when Munshie came around, they were so happy and in love with her. The relationship that she had with her parents was very special. She was incredibly close to both of her parents, but she was particularly close with her mother. At the age of 5, Munshie started calligraphy and also began painting. While in school, she was required to learn English, and to everyone's surprise, English came naturally for her. Even in her elementary years, she did amazing with it. From a young age, her parents knew that she was very intelligent and very talented. Overall, Munshie was a very creative young lady with her calligraphy, painting, and as she got older, she started getting interested in photography. She was also interested in singing and began playing the erhu, which is a Chinese two-stringed musical instrument that is held in the player's lap and it's played with a bow. Munshie was also adventurous and enjoyed going to summer camps and other social activities in her younger years. After graduating high school, Munshie moved 14 hours away from her parents and attended East China University of Science and Technology in Shanghai. Her parents were beyond proud of her that she got accepted into this university. It is said that it is extremely hard to get accepted into these top universities in Shanghai, and it is very, very competitive. You have to be very smart and at the top of your class for them to even consider you as a potential student. But Munshie got in and earned her bachelor's degree in engineering. And though she was 14 hours from home, Munshie always made sure to speak to her family daily. It was something that they looked forward to, and so did she. After earning her bachelor's degree, Munshi went to the United States to further her education. The family's lawyer, Amy Saladay, told Columbia Daily Tribune that education and study in other countries, particularly in the United States, is highly valued in China. So it was always a goal and dream of Munshi's to do just that. She was accepted into the University of Missouri in 2012, and she made arrangements for housing with six other students. Munshi was a part of an exchange program that the school offered that would allow her to complete her master's degree in engineering. And in December 2014, she earned her degree in mechanical and aerospace engineering. If you can't tell, Munshi was a brilliant woman. She had impressed one of her professors so much that he hired her immediately upon graduation to work for his biomaterials company called Nanova. While working at Nanova, Munshi excelled and became a supervisor fairly quickly. Sometime in 2015, she met Joseph Elledge when he came to work at Nanova, and she was his supervisor. Joe was a student at the University of Missouri, also studying engineering when he was hired at Nanova. Right off the bat, Munshi and Joe clicked, and they quickly fell in love. After dating for just over a year and a half, Joe got down on one knee on a trail in Rockbridge Memorial State Park and asked Munshi to marry him. She readily agreed, and within 2 weeks, the couple officially tied the knot. There was a bit of a rush to get married because Munshi's visa was about to expire. And I want to pause for a second and add in something that a woman by the name of Yao Li said when talking about Munshi and her case. Now, Yao Li is a Chinese immigrant, and she is an assistant prosecutor in Boone County in Missouri. She also helped Munshi's family communicate with those investigating and working on her case. Anyway, Yao Li was saying in an interview that being an immigrant is extremely stressful because they obviously need a visa to stay within the states. Many immigrants, Munshi included, are beyond capable of taking care of themselves and providing for themselves financially, yet they can't get a green card alone. She talks about how the need for a green card for immigrants creates a power dynamic in marriages, where the born American essentially holds power over the immigrant. I just wanted to make sure I added that because I think it's important to kind of think about that information as I continued to give the details of Munshi's case. So as I said, they rushed to get married because Munshi's visa was about to expire. From the start of their marriage, things were as normal as ever. They continued about their regular lives and all seemed to be going well for them. But 5 months into the marriage, Munshi got offered a new job, and this was a huge deal and something that she deserved so much. But around the time that she got offered this big new job, she also found out that she was pregnant, and she and Joe decided that she would turn down this job so that she could focus on being a full-time mom when the baby came. They made this decision even though at that time, Munshi was the sole provider for their growing family because Joe had quit working so that he could focus on school. You would think that they would have wanted Munshi to take this job because it was such a huge opportunity and maybe Joe could have been a stay-at-home dad. But it seems like that wasn't even up for discussion and that he wanted her to care for the child fully and not work. In October 2018, Munshi and Joe welcomed their baby girl into the world, and Munshi began her journey as a stay-at-home mom. This is also when things really started to change for Munshi and Joe. After the birth of their daughter, Munshi's parents flew in from China and began staying with them to help care for their newborn baby. It is Chinese custom for grandparents to come and help for 100 days. And Jo did not like having her family, specifically her mom, around, and would say that her mom was purposely causing problems. He told Munshi that he wanted her mother to leave, and instead of agreeing with him, she stood up against him and said, "No." She said, "I need my mother here." She told him that she needed to take care of herself, she needed to care for her own body and her health, and the responsible thing to do is to take care of herself and have her mother there to help with their newborn baby. This infuriated Jo. One thing that he was livid about was the fact that Munshi and her mother would speak Chinese together in front of Jo. Jo knew just a little bit of Chinese, but he wasn't fluid, and so he automatically assumed that they were talking about him anytime that he didn't understand what they were saying, which was the majority of the time. And this stressed him out and made him even more mad. Clearly, he has a control issue, and the fact that Munshi was not bending to his every wish was really pushing him over the edge. Munshi's father left the States before her mother did, and it was after he left when things started to escalate further. One night, Karen was making Chinese dumplings to celebrate her son-in-law's birthday. It was Joe's birthday. What was meant to be a nice thing that her mother was doing for Jo turned into a nasty blow-up fight. Prosecutors later refer to this incident as the cutting board incident because this entire fight had been audio recorded by Munshi, which you will later learn more about. Recording conversations she had with Jo is something that she started to frequently do before she went missing. In the audio, you can hear Jo freaking out about the way that Karen was using his cutting board. He was saying things like, "Don't do my cutting board like that. The cutting board doesn't like that." And I'm not sure how someone can misuse a flippin' cutting board, but however Karen was cutting on it or using this cutting board made Jo go freaking ballistic. He demanded that she get out of his house. He demanded that she never come back. And he even told Munshi that if she comes back, he will make her go away for good. And you can bet your ass on that. In the audio, you can hear Munshi fighting back with Jo, telling him that he isn't a god. And he replies with, quote, "I am an effing god. If I say your mom don't stay here, she don't stay here," end quote. Munshi went on pleading with Jo to please drop it, let her mother stay, and he just got even nastier, telling her pretty much that she was worthless, she was brainless, and that she was nothing because she was a woman. He said, quote, "You think you're so empowered because of this society. You're still just a woman," end quote. Both Karen and Munshi were at a loss for words. They didn't know why something so small could cause Jo to blow up so badly. And Munshi didn't know what to do, so she actually called Jo's mother, who lived 2 hours away, begging for her help. His mother, Jean, drove to town and tried to sit down with them to be kind of like a mediator as they worked through this entire situation. Munshi recorded this conversation with his mother as well. In the audio, you can hear Munshi telling Jean that she doesn't know what to do. She pretty much tells her she's scared that, quote, "unpredictable things will happen." To me, this is proof that Munshi was scared of Jo, that he was getting out of control, that he was trying to exercise some power or right that he felt he had over Munshi, and that she feared what would happen if she continued to stand up for herself and for her mother. Jo made very threatening remarks in some of that audio that Munshi recorded. He talked about taking control of nature and breaking its effing neck and killing it. Prosecutors later stated that they believe that this was his metaphor for what he wanted to do to Munshi or her mother. Now, when his mother Jean was at their house, Joe was not censored at all in front of his own mother about how he felt about his mother-in-law. Eventually, though, Joe cooled off, he apologized to Karen, but he still made her leave. And sadly, Karen was forced to leave before her 100 days were over. Yao Li, the assistant prosecutor I mentioned earlier that worked closely with Munshi's family and also the person who later translated Munshi's journals, said that Karen felt like Joe's apology was sincere and that she felt like things between the two were going to get better once she left. Yao Li states that had her mother thought otherwise, she would have stayed to be with Munshi. Unfortunately, things did not get better. They only got worse. In her private journals, Munshi wrote about being upset for not leaving Joe. She wrote and questioned herself on why she stays with him. But prosecutors believed that she stayed because she felt trapped due to her immigration status. But 5 months after Munshi would go missing, she was due to have another immigration interview. And it was during this interview that she was going to be applying for her permanent green card that would allow her to stay in the country for good. Sadly, Munshi would never get that permanent green card. On October 10th, 2019, the Columbia Police Department received a phone call from a man named Joseph Elledge. He was calling to report his wife, 28-year-old Munshi Ji, missing. He stated that the last time that he had seen her was 2 days before when they went to bed for the night. Now, I do want to add quickly that Joe didn't report his wife missing until his mother-in-law told a friend of hers that lived near where Munshi and Joe lived that she hadn't heard from her daughter. Munshi's mom, Karen, asked this friend to go over to Joe and Munshi's home to check on her. As I mentioned earlier, Munshi talked daily with her mom. So the moment she didn't hear from her daughter on October 9th, Karen knew something was wrong. When this friend stopped by to check on Munshi, Joe answered the door and told them that she hadn't been to the house in a couple of days. The following day is when Joe called to report her missing. Now, when he called, he did not call 911, which this stuck out as odd to the investigators right off the bat. Usually, when people report someone missing, they call 911. But instead, Joe called the non-emergency line and was very calm when stating that he hadn't seen his wife in a few days. According to Joe, on the evening of October 8th, he and Munshi were enjoying a quiet night at home. They had been fighting the week prior, he says, but on that particular night, all was well. He had given her a back massage and made sure to draw it out so that they could spend good quality time together. But Munshi eventually called it a night, telling him that she had to be awake early the following morning to go somewhere. Joe stated that he asked her multiple times where she was going and who she was meeting, but she wouldn't tell him. Joe said that they went to sleep, and when he woke up in the morning, she was gone. According to Joe, she had left behind her phone and wedding ring, but she took her purse with her. He said that on the day that he woke up and she was gone, he went on 2 long drives in her car with their 1-year-old daughter in the back seat. When asked what he was doing on these drives, he stated that he was looking for new hiking trails. Now, the fact that he offered up this information willingly was odd and was a major red flag to the authorities. So they asked Joe, "Did you lock your door when you left the house?" And he said yes. Then they asked him, if you locked the door, how did you expect your wife to get back inside the house if she showed up and you had her keys, her car, and her phone? She couldn't call anybody. How did you expect her to get inside? What did you think she would do? He sat there silently for a moment and then replied, yeah, I don't know. Immediately, the detectives were looking at this guy as a suspect and that foul play was involved. It almost seemed like with these specific questions about him locking the door, they kind of backed him in a corner right off the bat that he wasn't expecting to be backed into. His story wasn't adding up. His demeanor wasn't adding up. Nothing was really adding up here. While talking to the investigators, Joe also told them that he found secret journal entries that Munchie had written on her computer. And in these entries, she talked about a secret lover that she had. Joe told the authorities that he believed that this man was in China and the two had been communicating and exchanging sexually explicit pictures. Joe told them that maybe Munchie had ran off to be with this man. But it became very clear that Munchie hadn't ordered an Uber, she didn't take any other rideshare service, nor had she purchased any plane tickets. Not to mention, Munchie would never, ever, ever, ever abandon her daughter. She was an amazing mother, and that little girl was her world. There was no way that she would up and leave without her. So while the authorities didn't believe Joe's story and they thought that foul play was involved, there was no physical evidence to prove something sinister happened. They had no blood evidence. They had no witnesses who said that they heard or saw anything. There was no weapons uncovered and there was no body. After being interviewed by police, Joe granted them access to his phone, and on his phone, they discovered 10 hours of recorded conversations that he had taken. Now, this is different recordings than the ones that I mentioned earlier. These ones were instead recorded by Joe himself, unbeknownst to Munchie. In these recordings, Joe is very calm discussing things with her. He wasn't the violent or yelling Joe that was heard in the recordings that Munchie had taken. In one of the recordings, Joe approached Munchie and told her that he wanted to discuss the end of their marriage. He stated that he wasn't happy with her, he doesn't like being married to her, and he doesn't like living with her. He wanted to know if she was going to cooperate with the divorce and told her that if she doesn't, he was going to tell the judge that she was abusive towards him and ask them to deport her. Clearly, this guy is trying to manipulate Munchie into doing everything he wanted. Once more, he thought that he had some sort of control over her and her immigration status. He tried to use that as a scare tactic and a manipulation tactic at any chance that he got. So when police initially responded to Munchie being missing, Joe stated that her phone and ring was left behind. He also willingly handed over her phone to police, but told them that he didn't know the passcode to unlock it. As soon as they were able to unlock her phone, they discovered over 4 hours of recorded conversations on her phone. And this is where they learned about that cutting board incident, among other things. In all of Joe's recordings, he's talking very calmly. But in Munchie's recordings, Joe is a whole other person making threats, cussing, yelling, trying to manipulate and gaslight her. So while the authorities were doing whatever they could to track down any and all leads, they kept their eyes on Joe because they felt like he held the answers to what happened to Munchie. Posters began popping up around Columbia, Missouri, with Munchie's pictures and details on it. And Joe even went and did a media interview asking for answers about where his wife was. In this interview, he also openly states that he knows that she was talking to another man, and wherever she is, he hopes she's being taken care of and is doing well. If you ask me, I feel like that's such an odd thing to say on national television. Sure, go ahead and say that you hope she's alive, you hope she's well wherever she's at, but to try and kind of throw her under the bus, essentially, for having an affair, it just seems like odd timing and like he was trying to shift the spotlight away from himself possibly being involved and more so shift it to planting this idea that she ran off with another man. I don't know. I just don't feel like this was an appropriate move on his part, but you guys will have to let me know your thoughts on that because I am super interested. So 2 weeks after her disappearance, the police announced that they were opening a criminal investigation into her disappearance. And on that same very day that they made this announcement, police showed up to Joe's apartment that he was at with his mother, and they arrested him. But surprisingly, it was not in connection to Munchie's disappearance. And instead, they were arresting him for suspicion that he physically abused his daughter. The police making the arrest tell Joe that they've become aware of some bruising that had been found on his daughter. And they ask him if he knew what they were talking about, and he replied with, "Yep." According to prosecutor Dan Knight, this information came from Karen, Munchie's mother. Munchie had confided in her mother, telling her that she had seen bruising on her daughter's butt. And Karen told her that she needed to confront Joe about it. Joe had admitted that his daughter was crying a lot one night, and out of frustration, he pinched her butt hard enough to leave a bruise. Joe's defense attorney, Scott Rosenblum, states that he believes that this entire arrest was just to get Joe into custody while they investigated Munchie's disappearance, and that the butt-pinching situation was just a mistake on Joe's part because he was a young father and there was zero other indications that he had ever been violent or abusive towards his daughter. Joe's bond was set to $500,000, and his mother gained temporary custody of his daughter. The same day that Joe was arrested, police executed a search warrant of the apartment that he shared with Munchie, and they found a lot of items of interest. One of the big things that they collected was a notebook that they found inside of a backpack. And inside this notebook were handwritten notes that Joe had wrote himself. These notes were about how to answer questions from reporters and during investigations. He wrote things like, "Don't speculate," "Nothing wrong with dead silence," "Don't speculate about how others are feeling, concentrate on how I feel." Add things like, quote, "I'm worried sick," and "the only emotion the public will relate to is sorrow and sadness." And the biggest red flag, oh my God, WTF thing that this man wrote in this script or whatever you want to call it is him saying, "Only speak in present tense. Don't confuse past and present." So clearly, this guy knows that when people get caught using past tense when speaking of someone, it could potentially mean that they know something bad had happened. The biggest question here is, why would a man who is completely innocent, who claims his wife possibly left with another man, have notes about how to address the media, interrogators, and notes reminding himself to speak of her as if she were still alive? This, to prosecutor Dan Knight, was practically a smoking gun. He felt like this was proof that Joe, for sure, killed Munchie. During the search, officers searched every single nook and cranny trying to find any potential evidence that they could find. They located a pair of muddy boots that belonged to Joe and decided to just go ahead and take those in as well. Thankfully, they did because they eventually became a key piece of evidence. One of the things investigators also did was retrace the steps that Joe said he took that day when he woke up to find his wife gone. He claimed that he and their one-year-old daughter went on two long leisurely drives. They were hopeful that maybe they could find something when retracing his steps, but that didn't lead them anywhere significant. With not a lot to go on, Dan Knight made the bold and risky move to go ahead and file charges against Joseph Elledge for first-degree murder, even though they didn't have Munchie's body. The search for Munchie's body intensified, and they began zeroing in on Joe's cell phone tower records for the day that she went missing. They found that he had spent just over 30 minutes at the Lamine River on that day. This was something that he hadn't told police about, so they sent a team out to begin diving and dragging the river, convinced that her body was somewhere in that water. For months, they searched this river, but they never found her or anything relating to her case. And this was extremely hard for not only Munchie's family, but investigators as well. In March 2020, they held a memorial at this river for Munchie, and her mom had flown from China to attend. They had really high hopes that they would find her there, but unfortunately, they came up empty-handed. A year after this memorial and 17 months after Munchie had first went missing, Joe Elledge was still in jail awaiting trial. On March 25, 2021, a hiker came upon skeletal remains in the Rock Bridge Memorial State Park, the very same park where Joe Elledge had proposed to Munchie G just years before. The hiker was walking through a heavily wooded area of the park when something colorful caught his eye. It was a purse. He used his walking stick to flip the purse over and kind of move it around, and he noticed that a pair of shoes were also lying there. The closer he looked, the more he realized that there was bones lying beside these items, and then he spotted a skull. Finally, Munchie was found, and it was absolutely devastating news for her parents. The medical examiner was unable to determine her cause of death, but he had found that she had substantial damage to her ribs. Four of her ribs had been broken completely through, not just cracks to the ribs, but completely broken through, proving that Munchie had taken a massive, massive blow to her back. And breaks completely through like that would have had Munchie in agonizing and excruciating pain. So looking back at Joe's cell phone tower pings for that day, Joe was near the burial site. And on that day, it had been raining. Hence those muddy boots I mentioned earlier. Now, those boots were about to blow this case wide open, and I am so completely fascinated by this part of the story. The boots that were caked with mud, gravel, and foliage were sent off for analysis. They found that there were 12 different types of vegetation that had been stuck inside the soles of these boots. Dan Knight then sent the boots to a lab at the Missouri Botanical Garden. There, they carefully extracted juniper tree needles from the soles for DNA testing. Now, what is absolutely crazy amazing, and I feel like I probably learned this in high school and then forgot about it until I started researching this case, is that plants have DNA just like we do. Every single tree, shrub, plant, flower all have their own individual DNA. I was substitute teaching a genetics class last week at the school that I work at, and they were actually just learning about plant DNA in the class. I made sure to tell them all about how DNA can solve crimes, and in this particular case, plant DNA solved this case. So once they extracted these juniper needles and began collecting the DNA from them, they sent a team out to Munchie's burial site to collect samples from each of the trees surrounding that area. This isn't an easy task either. You can't just go out there and collect pieces of the trees off the ground. The team had to get on a ladder and then use a 10 to 15 foot pole pruner to reach up high into the tree to make sure that the pieces of the tree that they were collecting were from the exact tree they wanted. They had to be extremely thorough and precise with it. After testing the numerous samples that they had collected, they were able to positively identify several of the needles that had been stuck in Joe's boots as belonging to trees directly around the gravesite. I couldn't find the exact number of murders that have been solved by using tree DNA, but Dan Knight, the prosecutor on this case, says this is only the second case he has ever heard of that has been solved using tree or plant DNA. On November 1st, 2021, Joe Elledge's trial began. It was no surprise that Joe's attorney came up with a new explanation on what had happened. Initially, they tried to say that she ran off with another man, but given the damning evidence that they couldn't explain away, Joe's defense had to explain why he buried his wife. At the trial, they were claiming that Joe had unintentionally killed his wife. The story now was that on the night of October 8th, 2019, Joe had been giving Munchie a massage, and that is when he tried to initiate sex and she turned him down. It was after she turns him down that he confronts her about her online romance with her lover in China. He was upset and hurt by this entire confrontation, and he tells her that he's going to leave the house for a walk with their daughter. Munchie got upset and told him no, and she jumped up and lunged at him. He pushed her hard away from him, and that is when she fell into the countertop, and that's when Joe claims that she broke her ribs. He claims that she got up and lunged for him again, and he pushed her off again, and this time she fell and hit her head. He said that she had gotten up for a second time and went to go to bed. And come morning, when the baby had woken up, Munchie was dead in their bed. Joe claims that he panicked, and instead of reporting what had happened, he placed her body in the trunk of her own car and took her out and buried her. Meanwhile, their daughter was strapped into her car seat in the back of the car, while her mother was stuffed in the trunk and then eventually buried. And that, to me, is probably one of the most heartbreaking things about this entire case. Their daughter was inside that home when Munchie died, and she was there when her mother was dumped into a shallow grave. Joe took the stand in his own defense and testified that despite tension in his marriage, he really loved his wife. While on the stand, he also tried to shift blame to Munchie, stating that she was the cause of most of the tension in the marriage. The defense tried their hardest to paint Munchie as the aggressor. After just over 2 long weeks of testimonies and evidence being presented in front of the jury, both sides gave their closing arguments. The defense asked for a manslaughter conviction, while the prosecution begged for first-degree murder. On November 11th, 2021, after 7 hours of deliberation, the jury came back with a verdict. They found Joseph Elledge guilty of second-degree murder. They believe that Joe had killed Munchie, but without premeditation. Munchie's parents were happy with this verdict. The jury sentenced Joe Elledge to 28 years in prison, giving him 1 year for every year of Munchie's short life. In December 2022, Munchie's parents and Joe's mother came to an agreement on the custody of Munchie's sweet little daughter. They agreed that her daughter will spend her summers in China, and the remaining of the year she will live in the States with Joe's mother, Jean. And from my understanding, from what I saw, Joe cannot have contact with his daughter. And it also sounds like the relationship between Jean and Munchie's parents is an incredible one. Jean and her husband do an amazing job raising this little girl, and they make sure to always include Munchie's parents in all aspects of her life. In August of 2023, Joe tried to appeal his murder conviction. According to KOMU.com, he argued that the evidence during his trial was not sufficient to convict him. That appeal was denied. Today, Joe Elledge is serving his time at the Southeast Correction Center in Charleston, Missouri. KRCG-TV reports that in addition to his 28-year prison sentence for the murder of his wife, he also received a 10-year sentence for child abuse, endangering the welfare of a child, and domestic assault. I'm happy to say that Joe is exactly where he belongs and will be there for a good long time. Before I wrap up this episode, I also want to take a moment and touch on some other heartbreaking news. The lead prosecutor for this case, Dan Knight, who fought tirelessly for justice for Munchie, was found deceased inside his home on June 4, 2022. According to ABC 17 News, he sadly died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. My heart absolutely breaks over this news. Obviously, I don't know the circumstances surrounding the reasons behind why he took his life. However, I just want to mention that there is something called secondary traumatic stress. Let me reiterate quickly again that I do not know what drove Dan to take his life, and I'm not saying he's suffered from any kind of mental illness or suffered from secondary traumatic stress, but I did want to mention STS because it's a very real thing and was something that I had to focus on during my senior year of my bachelor's in criminology and criminal justice. STS is the emotional duress that results when an individual hears or sees firsthand trauma experiences of another. STS isn't talked about often, but it is a very real thing for those exposed to the worst of the worst. This includes doctors, police officers, firefighters, EMTs, therapists, lawyers. The list goes on and on. This was something I had to focus on for my senior capstone, and we were required to read a book called Trauma Stewardship, An Everyday Guide to Caring for Self While Caring for Others. I won't go on and on about this topic, but if you're interested in learning more, I highly recommend this book. Secondary traumatic stress was something I never even considered or thought about, but it's extremely important to learn about and learn how to recognize signs that you may be struggling from STS. If you're considering going into any of the careers I listed, I cannot recommend this book more. I know a lot of first responders who have personally read this book and they keep it to refer back to. It is a book that I also kept for myself that I feel is a valuable tool that I can reflect back on. I will have the book linked in the description of this episode for anyone interested in checking it out. Again, I'm not saying that Dan Knight struggled with STS. He might have had other things happening in his life, but it is a possibility. Crimesters, that is all for this week's episode. I hope you all have enjoyed the opportunity to learn about how freaking cool science can be, and the amazing advances that we've made in science that has gone on to help solve cases. If you're not already a part of my private Facebook group, make sure you find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group on Facebook. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. You can also follow me over on Instagram at CrimeAHolly. And if you'd like more true crime content, you can follow me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. If you guys haven't already left a review for me, please hit that 5-star on your preferred podcast platform. This not only makes my day when I see another 5-star rating, but it also helps my podcast grow by recommending the podcast to consumers like you. Thank you guys so much for your constant love and support. Without all of you guys, I wouldn't be here every single week bringing you a new case. I love you all so much and appreciate you more than you know. I will be back next week with another episode for you guys. But until then, be aware and take care, my friends. Bye-bye.